tends to tell a long story, that our name is one of the most ancient in France. And with a Frenchman's easy and naive frankness, the captain told Pierre the story of his ancestors, his childhood, youth, and manhood, and all about his relations and his financial and family affairs. Ma pauvre mère playing, of course, an important part in the story. But all that is only life's setting. The real thing is love. Love! Am I not right, Monsieur Pierre? Said he, growing animated. Another glass. Pierre again emptied his glass and poured himself out a third. Oh, women! Women! And the captain, looking with glistening eyes at Pierre, began talking of love and of his love affairs. There were very many of these, as one could easily believe, looking at the officer's handsome, self-satisfied face, and noting the eager enthusiasm with which he spoke of women. Though all Rombal's love stories had the sensual character which Frenchmen regard as the special charm and poetry of love, yet he told his story with such sincere conviction that he alone had experienced and known all the charm of love, and he described women so alluringly that Pierre listened to him with curiosity. It was plain that l'amour, which the Frenchman was so fond of, was not that low and simple kind that Pierre had once felt for his wife, nor was it the romantic love stimulated by himself that he experienced for Natasha. Rombal despised both these kinds of love equally, the one he considered the love of clodhoppers, and the other the love of simpletons. L'amour, which the Frenchman worshipped, consisted principally in the unnaturalness of his relation to the woman, and in a combination of incongruities giving the chief charm to the feeling. Thus the captain touchingly recounted the story of his love for a fascinating marquise of 35, and at the same time for a charming, innocent child of 17, daughter of the bewitching marquise. The conflict of magnanimity between the mother and the daughter, ending in the mother's sacrificing herself and offering her daughter in marriage to her lover, even now agitated the captain, though it was the memory of a distant past. Then he recounted an episode in which the husband played the part of the lover, and he, the lover, assumed the role of the husband, as well as several droll incidents from his recollections of Germany, where shelter is called Unterkunft, and where the husbands eat sauerkraut and the young girls are too blonde. Finally, the latest episode in Poland, still fresh in the captain's memory, and which he narrated with rapid gestures and glowing face, was of how he had saved the life of a Pole. In general, the saving of life continually occurred in the captain's stories, and the Pole entrusted to him his enchanting wife, Parisienne de cœur, while himself entering the French service. The captain was happy, the enchanting Polish lady wished to elope with him, but prompted by magnanimity, the captain restored the wife to the husband, saying as he did so, "I have saved your life, and I save your honour." Having repeated these words, the captain wiped his eyes and gave himself a shake, as if driving away the weakness which assailed him at this touching recollection. Listening to the captain's tales, Pierre, as often happens late in the evening and under the influence of wine, followed all that was told him, understood it all, and at the same time followed a train of personal memories which, he knew not why, suddenly arose in his mind. While listening to these love stories, his own love for Natasha unexpectedly rose to his mind. And going over the pictures of that love in his imagination, he mentally compared them with Rombal's tales. Listening to the story of the struggle between love and duty, Pierre saw before his eyes every minutest detail of his last meeting with the object of his love at the Sukharev water tower. At the time of that meeting, it had not produced an effect upon him. He had not even once recalled it. But now it seemed to him that that meeting had in it something very important and poetic.
"Pyotr Kirillovich, come here. We have recognized you."
He now seemed to hear the words she had uttered, and to see before him her eyes, her smile, her travelling hood, and a stray lock of her hair. And there seemed to him something pathetic and touching in all this. Having finished his tale about the enchanting Polish lady, the captain asked Pierre if he had ever experienced a similar impulse to sacrifice himself for love, and a feeling of envy of the legitimate husband. Challenged by this question, Pierre raised his head and felt a need to express the thoughts that filled his mind. He began to explain that he understood love for a woman somewhat differently. He said that in all his life he had loved, and still loved, only one woman, and that she could never be his. "Tiens," said the captain. Pierre then explained that he had loved this woman from his earliest years, but that he had not dared to think of her, because she was too young, and because he had been an illegitimate son without a name. Afterwards, when he had received a name and wealth, he dared not think of her because he loved her too well, placing her far above everything in the world, and especially, therefore, above himself. When he had reached this point, Pierre asked the captain whether he understood that. The captain made a gesture, signifying that even if he did not understand it, he begged Pierre to continue. "Platonic love, clouds," he muttered. Whether it was the wine he had drunk, or an impulse of frankness, or the thought that this man did not and never would know any of those who played a part in his story, or whether it was all these things together, something loosened Pierre's tongue. Speaking thickly and with a faraway look in his shining eyes, he told the whole story of his life, his marriage, Natasha's love for his best friend, her betrayal of him, and all his own simple relations with her. Urged on by Rombal's questions, he also told what he had at first concealed, his own position, and even his name. More than anything else in Pierre's story, the captain was impressed by the fact that Pierre was very rich, had two mansions in Moscow, and that he had abandoned everything and not left the city, but remained there concealing his name and station. When it was late at night, they went out together into the street. The night was warm and light. To the left of the house on the Pokrovka, a fire glowed, the first of those that were beginning in Moscow. To the right and high up in the sky was the sickle of the waning moon, and opposite to it hung that bright comet which was connected in Pierre's heart with his love. At the gate stood Gerasim, the cook, and two Frenchmen. Their laughter and their mutually incomprehensible remarks in two languages could be heard. They were looking at the glow seen in the town. There was nothing terrible in the one small distant fire in the immense city. Gazing at the high starry sky, at the moon, at the comet, and at the glow from the fire, Pierre experienced a joyful emotion. "There now, how good it is! What more does one need?" thought he. And suddenly remembering his intention, he grew dizzy and felt so faint that he leaned against the fence to save himself from falling. Without taking leave of his new friend, Pierre left the gate with unsteady steps and, returning to his room, lay down on the sofa and immediately fell asleep. Chapter 30. The Rostovs at Mytishchi. The glow of the first fire that began on the 2nd of September was watched from the various roads by the fugitive Muscovites and by the retreating troops, with many different feelings. The Rostov party spent the night at Mytishchi, 14 miles from Moscow. They had started so late on the 1st of September, the road had been so blocked by vehicles and troops, so many things had been forgotten for which servants were sent back, that they had decided to spend that night at a place 3 miles out of Moscow. The next morning they woke late and were again delayed so often that they only got as far as Great Mytishchi. At 10 o'clock that evening, the Rostov family and the wounded travelling with them were all distributed in the yards and huts of that large village. The Rostov servants and coachmen and the orderlies of the wounded officers, after attending to their masters, had supper, fed the horses, and came out into the porches. In a neighbouring hut lay Raevsky's adjutant with a fractured wrist. The awful pain he suffered made him moan incessantly and piteously, and his moaning sounded terrible in the darkness of the autumn night. He had spent the first night in the same yard as the Rostovs. The countess said she had been unable to close her eyes on account of his moaning, and at Mitishchi she moved into a worse hut, simply to be farther away from the wounded man. In the darkness of the night, one of the servants noticed above the high body of a coach standing before the porch the small glow of another fire. One glow had long been visible, and everybody knew that it was little Mitishchi burning, set on fire by Mamonov's Cossacks.
"But look here, brothers, here's another fire," remarked an orderly.
All turned their attention to the glow.
"But they told us little Mitishchi had been set on fire by Mamonov's Cossacks."
"But that's not Mitishchi. It's farther away."
"Look, it must be in Moscow."
Two of the gazers went round to the other side of the coach and sat down on its steps.
"It's more to the left. Why, little Mitishchi is over there, and this is right on the other side."
Several men joined the first two.
"See how it's flaring," said one. "That's a fire in Moscow, either in the Sushchevsky or the Rogozhsky quarter."
No one replied to this remark, and for some time they all gazed silently at the spreading flames of the second fire in the distance. Old Daniel Terentich, the Count's valet, as he was called, came up to the group and shouted at Mishka.
"What are you staring at, you good for nothing? The Count will be calling and there's nobody there. Go and gather the clothes together."
"I only ran out to get some water," said Mishka.
"But what do you think, Daniel Terentich? Doesn't it look as if that glow were in Moscow?"
remarked one of the footmen. Daniel Terentich made no reply, and again for a long time they were all silent. The glow spread, rising and falling, farther and farther still.
"God have mercy! It's windy and dry," said another voice.
"Just look, see what it's doing now. Oh, Lord, you can even see the crows flying. Lord have mercy on us sinners. They'll put it out, no fear."
"Who's to put it out?"
Daniel Terentich, who had hitherto been silent, was heard to say. His voice was calm and deliberate.
"Moscow it is, brothers," said he. "Mother Moscow. The white."
His voice faltered, and he gave way to an old man's sob. And it was as if they had all only waited for this, to realize the significance for them of the glow they were watching. Sighs were heard, words of prayer, and the sobbing of the Count's old valet.
Chapter 31. The valet, returning to the cottage, informed the Count that Moscow was burning. The Count donned his dressing gown and went out to look. Sonya and Madame Schoss, who had not yet undressed, went out with him. Only Natasha and the Countess remained in the room. Petya was no longer with the family. He had gone on with his regiment, which was making for Troitsa. The Countess, on hearing that Moscow was on fire, began to cry. Natasha, pale with a fixed look, was sitting on the bench under the icons just where she had sat down on arriving, and paid no attention to her father's words. She was listening to the ceaseless moaning of the adjutant, three houses off.
"Oh, how terrible," said Sonya, returning from the yard, chilled and frightened. "I believe the whole of Moscow will burn. There's an awful glow. Natasha, do look. You can see it from the window," she said to her cousin, evidently wishing to distract her mind.
But Natasha looked at her as if not understanding what was said to her, and again fixed her eyes on the corner of the stove. She had been in this condition of stupor since the morning, when Sonya, to the surprise and annoyance of the Countess, had for some unaccountable reason found it necessary to tell Natasha of Prince Andrei's wound and of his being with their party. The Countess had seldom been so angry with anyone as she was with Sonya. Sonya had cried and begged to be forgiven, and now, as if trying to atone for her fault, paid unceasing attention to her cousin.
"Look, Natasha, how dreadfully it is burning," said she. "What's burning?" asked Natasha. "Oh, yes, Moscow."
And as if in order not to offend Sonya and to get rid of her, she turned her face to the window, looked out in such a way that it was evident that she could not see anything, and again settled down in her former attitude.
"But you didn't see it." "Yes, really, I did," Natasha replied in a voice that pleaded to be left in peace.
Both the Countess and Sonya understood that, naturally, neither Moscow nor the burning of Moscow nor anything else could seem of importance to Natasha. The Count returned and lay down behind the partition. The Countess went up to her daughter and touched her head with the back of her hand, as she was wont to do when Natasha was ill, then touched her forehead with her lips as if to feel whether she was feverish, and finally kissed her.
"You are cold. You are trembling all over. You'd better lie down," said the Countess. "Lie down? All right, I will. I'll lie down at once," said Natasha.
When Natasha had been told that morning that Prince Andrei was seriously wounded and was travelling with their party, she had at first asked many questions. Where was he going? How was he wounded? Was it serious? And could she see him? But after she had been told that she could not see him, that he was seriously wounded, but that his life was not in danger, she ceased to ask questions or to speak at all, evidently disbelieving what they told her, and convinced that, say what she might, she would still be told the same. All the way she had sat motionless in a corner of the coach with wide-open eyes, and the expression in them which the Countess knew so well and feared so much. And now she sat in the same way on the bench where she had seated herself on arriving. She was planning something, and either deciding or had already decided something in her mind. The Countess knew this, but what it might be she did not know, and this alarmed and tormented her.
"Natasha, undress, darling. Lie down on my bed."
A bed had been made on a bedstead for the Countess only. Madame Schoss and the two girls were to sleep on some hay on the floor.
"No, Mama, I will lie down here on the floor," Natasha replied irritably, and she went to the window and opened it.
Through the open window the moans of the adjutant could be heard more distinctly. She put her head out into the damp night air, and the Countess saw her slim neck shaking with sobs and throbbing against the window frame. Natasha knew it was not Prince Andrei who was moaning. She knew Prince Andrei was in the same yard as themselves, and in a part of the hut across the passage. But this dreadful, incessant moaning made her sob. The Countess exchanged a look with Sonya.
"Lie down, darling. Lie down, my pet," said the Countess, softly touching Natasha's shoulders. "Come, lie down." "Oh, yes, I'll lie down at once," said Natasha, and began hurriedly undressing, tugging at the tapes of her petticoat.
When she had thrown off her dress and put on a dressing jacket, she sat down with her foot under her on the bed that had been made up on the floor, jerked her thin and rather short plait of hair to the front, and began re-plaiting it. Her long, thin, practiced fingers rapidly unplaited, re-plaited, and tied up her plait. Her head moved from side to side from habit, but her eyes, feverishly wide, looked fixedly before her. When her toilette for the night was finished, she sank gently onto the sheet spread over the hay on the side nearest the door.
"Natasha, you'd better lie in the middle," said Sonya.
"I'll stay here," muttered Natasha. "Do lie down," she added crossly, and buried her face in the pillow.
The Countess, Madame Schoss, and Sonya undressed hastily and lay down. The small lamp in front of the icons was the only light left in the room, but in the yard there was a light from the fire at Little Mitishchi, a mile and a half away, and through the night came the noise of people shouting at a tavern Mamonov's Cossacks had set up across the street, and the adjutant's unceasing moans could still be heard. For a long time Natasha listened attentively to the sounds that reached her from inside and outside the room, and did not move. First she heard her mother praying and sighing, and the creaking of her bed under her, then Madame Schoss's familiar whistling snore and Sonya's gentle breathing. Then the Countess called to Natasha. Natasha did not answer.
I think she's asleep, Mama, said Sonya softly.
After a short silence, the Countess spoke again, but this time no one replied. Soon after that, Natasha heard her mother's even breathing. Natasha did not move, though her little bare foot, thrust out from under the quilt, was growing cold on the bare floor. As if to celebrate a victory over everybody, a cricket chirped in a crack in the wall. A cock crowed far off, and another replied nearby. The shouting in the tavern had died down. Only the moaning of the adjutant was heard. Natasha sat up.
Sonya, are you asleep? Mama?
She whispered. No one replied. Natasha rose slowly and carefully, crossed herself, and stepped cautiously on the cold and dirty floor with her slim, supple, bare feet. The boards of the floor creaked. Stepping cautiously from one foot to the other, she ran like a kitten the few steps to the door and grasped the cold door handle. It seemed to her that something heavy was beating rhythmically against all the walls of the room. It was her own heart, sinking with alarm and terror, and overflowing with love. She opened the door and stepped across the threshold and onto the cold, damp, earthen floor of the passage. The cold she felt refreshed her. With her bare feet she touched a sleeping man, stepped over him, and opened the door into the part of the hut where Prince Andrei lay. It was dark in there. In the farthest corner, on a bench beside a bed on which something was lying, stood a tallow candle with a long, thick and smouldering wick. From the moment she had been told that morning of Prince Andrei's wound and his presence there, Natasha had resolved to see him. She did not know why she had to. She knew the meeting would be painful, but she felt the more convinced that it was necessary. All day she had lived only in hope of seeing him that night, but now that the moment had come, she was filled with dread of what she might see. How was he maimed? What was left of him? Was he like that incessant moaning of the adjutants? Yes, he was altogether like that. In her imagination, he was that terrible moaning personified. When she saw an indistinct shape in the corner and mistook his knees raised under the quilt for his shoulders, she imagined a horrible body there and stood still in terror. But an irresistible impulse drew her forward. She cautiously took one step and then another and found herself in the middle of a small room containing baggage. Another man, Timokhin, was lying in a corner on the benches beneath the icons, and two others, the doctor and a valet, lay on the floor. The valet sat up and whispered something. Timokhin, kept awake by the pain in his wounded leg, gazed with wide-open eyes at this strange apparition of a girl in a white chemise, dressing jacket and nightcap. The valet's sleepy, frightened exclamation, "What do you want? What's the matter?" made Natasha approach more swiftly to what was lying in the corner. Horribly unlike a man as that body looked, she must see him. She passed the valet, the snuff fell from the candle wick, and she saw Prince Andrei clearly with his arms outside the quilt, and such as she had always seen him. He was the same as ever, but the feverish colour of his face, his glittering eyes rapturously turned toward her, and especially his neck, delicate as a child's, revealed by the turned-down collar of his shirt, gave him a peculiarly innocent, childlike look, such as she had never seen on him before. She went up to him and with a swift, flexible, youthful movement dropped on her knees. He smiled and held out his hand to her. Chapter 32. 7 days had passed since Prince Andrei found himself in the ambulance station on the field of Borodino. His feverish state and the inflammation of his bowels, which were injured, were, in the doctor's opinion, sure to carry him off. But on the 7th day he ate with pleasure a piece of bread with some tea, and the doctor noticed that his temperature was lower. He had regained consciousness that morning. The first night after they left Moscow had been fairly warm and he had remained in the caleche, but at Mytishchi the wounded man himself asked to be taken out and given some tea. The pain caused by his removal into the hut had made him groan aloud and again lose consciousness. When he had been placed on his camp bed, he lay for a long time motionless with closed eyes. Then he opened them and whispered softly, "And the tea?" His remembering such a small detail of everyday life astonished the doctor. He felt Prince Andrei's pulse, and to his surprise and dissatisfaction found it had improved. He was dissatisfied because he knew by experience that if his patient did not die now, he would do so a little later with greater suffering. Timokhin, the red-nosed major of Prince Andrei's regiment, had joined him in Moscow and was being taken along with him, having been wounded in the leg at the Battle of Borodino. They were accompanied by a doctor, Prince Andrei's valet, his coachman, and two orderlies. They gave Prince Andrei some tea. He drank it eagerly, looking with feverish eyes at the door in front of him, as if trying to understand and remember something. "I don't want any more. Is Timokhin here?" he asked. Timokhin crept along the bench to him. "I am here, Your Excellency." "How's your wound?" "Mine, sir. All right. But how about you?" Prince Andrei again pondered as if trying to remember something. "Couldn't one get a book?" he asked.
"What book?"
"The Gospels. I haven't one." The doctor promised to procure it for him and began to ask how he was feeling. Prince Andrei answered all his questions reluctantly but reasonably, and then said he wanted a bolster placed under him as he was uncomfortable and in great pain. The doctor and valet lifted the cloak with which he was covered, and making wry faces at the noisome smell of mortifying flesh that came from the wound, began examining that dreadful place. The doctor was very much displeased about something, and made a change in the dressings, turning the wounded man over so that he groaned again and grew unconscious and delirious from the agony. He kept asking them to get him the book and put it under him.
"What trouble would it be to you?" he said. "I have not got one. Please get it for me and put it under me for a moment," he pleaded in a piteous voice.
The doctor went into the passage to wash his hands.
"You fellows have no conscience," said he to the valet who was pouring water over his hands. "For just one moment I didn't look after you. It's such pain, you know, that I wonder how he can bear it."
"By the Lord Jesus Christ, I thought we'd put something under him," said the valet.
The first time Prince Andrei understood where he was and what was the matter with him, and remembered being wounded and how, was when he asked to be carried into the hut after his caleche had stopped at Mytishchi. After growing confused from pain while being carried into the hut, he had again regained consciousness, and while drinking tea once more recalled all that had happened to him, and above all vividly remembered the moment at the ambulance station when, at the sight of the sufferings of a man he disliked, those new thoughts had come to him which promised him happiness. And those thoughts, though now vague and indefinite, again possessed his soul. He remembered that he had now a new source of happiness, and that this happiness had something to do with the Gospels. That was why he asked for a copy of them. The uncomfortable position in which they had put him and turned him over again confused his thoughts, and when he came to himself a third time, it was in the complete stillness of the night. Everybody near him was sleeping. A cricket chirped from across the passage. Someone was shouting and singing in the street. Cockroaches rustled on the table, on the icons and on the walls, and a big fly flopped at the head of the bed and around the candle beside him, the wick of which was charred and had shaped itself like a mushroom. His mind was not in a normal state. A healthy man usually thinks of, feels and remembers innumerable things simultaneously, but has the power and will to select one sequence of thoughts or events on which to fix his whole attention. A healthy man can tear himself away from the deepest reflections to say a civil word to someone who comes in, and can then return again to his own thoughts. But Prince Andrei's mind was not in a normal state in that respect. All the powers of his mind were more active and clearer than ever, but they acted apart from his will. Most diverse thoughts and images occupied him simultaneously. At times his brain suddenly began to work with a vigour, clearness, and depth it had never reached when he was in health, but suddenly in the midst of its work it would turn to some unexpected idea, and he had not the strength to turn it back again.
Yes, a new happiness was revealed to me, of which man cannot be deprived, he thought as he lay in the semi-darkness of the quiet hut, gazing fixedly before him with feverish wide-open eyes. A happiness lying beyond material forces, outside the material influences that act on man. A happiness of the soul alone, the happiness of loving. Every man can understand it, but to conceive it and enjoin it was possible only for God. But how did God enjoin that law? And why was the sun...
And suddenly the sequence of these thoughts broke off, and Prince Andrei heard, without knowing whether it was a delusion or reality, a soft, whispering voice incessantly and rhythmically repeating,
"Pity, pity, pity, pity,"
and then,
"Titi,"
and then again,
"Pity, pity, pity,"
and
"Titi,"
once more. At the same time he felt that above his face, above the very middle of it, some strange airy structure was being erected out of slender needles or splinters to the sound of this whispered music. He felt that he had to balance carefully, though it was difficult, so that this airy structure should not collapse. But nevertheless it kept collapsing, and again slowly rising to the sound of whispered rhythmic music. It stretches, stretches, spreading out and stretching, said Prince Andrei to himself. While listening to this whispering and feeling the sensation of this drawing out and the construction of this edifice of needles, he also saw by glimpses a red halo round the candle, and heard the rustle of the cockroaches and the buzzing of the fly that flopped against his pillow and his face. Each time the fly touched his face, it gave him a burning sensation, and yet, to his surprise, it did not destroy the structure, though it knocked against the very region of his face where it was rising. But besides this, there was something else of importance. It was something white by the door. The statue of a sphinx, which also oppressed him.
But perhaps that's my shirt on the table, he thought, and that's my legs, and that is the door. But why is it always stretching and drawing itself out, and pity, 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 and titi, and pity, pity, pity? That's enough, please leave off.
Prince Andrei painfully entreated someone, and suddenly thoughts and feelings again swam to the surface of his mind with peculiar clearness and force.
Yes, love,
he thought again quite clearly, but not love which loves for something, for some quality, for some purpose, or for some reason, but the love which I, while dying, first experienced when I saw my enemy and yet loved him. I experienced that feeling of love, which is the very essence of the soul, and does not require an object. Now again, I feel that bliss. To love one's neighbours, to love one's enemies, to love everything, to love God in all his manifestations, it is possible to love someone dear to you with human love, but an enemy can only be loved by divine love. That is why I experienced such joy when I felt that I loved that man. What has become of him? Is he alive? When loving with human love, one may pass from love to hatred, but divine love cannot change. No,
Neither death nor anything else can destroy it. It is the very essence of the soul. Yet, how many people have I hated in my life? And of them all, I loved and hated none as I did her. And he vividly pictured to himself Natasha, not as he had done in the past, with nothing but her charms which gave him delight, but for the first time picturing to himself her soul. And he understood her feelings, her sufferings, shame and remorse. He now understood for the first time all the cruelty of his rejection of her, the cruelty of his rupture with her. If only it were possible for me to see her once more, just once, looking into those eyes to say, "Pity, pity, pity, and titi, and pity, pity, pity." Boom! Flopped the fly. And his attention was suddenly carried into another world, a world of reality and delirium in which something particular was happening. In that world some structure was still being erected and did not fall. Something was still stretching out, and the candle with its red halo was still burning, and the same shirt-like sphinx lay near the door. But besides all this, something creaked. There was a whiff of fresh air, and a new white sphinx appeared standing at the door. And that sphinx had the pale face and shining eyes of the very Natasha of whom he had just been thinking. "Oh, how oppressive this continual delirium is," thought Prince Andrei, trying to drive that face from his imagination. But the face remained before him with the force of reality and drew nearer. Prince Andrei wished to return to that former world of pure thought, but he could not, and delirium drew him back into its domain. The soft, whispering voice continued its rhythmic murmur. Something oppressed him and stretched out, and the strange face was before him. Prince Andrei collected all his strength in an effort to recover his senses. He moved a little, and suddenly there was a ringing in his ears, a dimness in his eyes, and like a man plunged into water, he lost consciousness. When he came to himself, Natasha, that same living Natasha, whom of all people he most longed to love, with this new, pure, divine love that had been revealed to him, was kneeling before him. He realized that it was the real living Natasha, and he was not surprised, but quietly happy. Natasha, motionless on her knees, she was unable to stir, with frightened eyes riveted on him, was restraining her sobs. Her face was pale and rigid. Only in the lower part of it something quivered. Prince Andrei sighed with relief, smiled, and held out his hand. "You?" he said. "How fortunate." With a rapid but careful movement, Natasha drew nearer to him on her knees, and taking his hand carefully, bent her face over it and began kissing it, just touching it lightly with her lips.
"Forgive me,"
she whispered, raising her head and glancing at him.
"Forgive me."
"I love you," said Prince Andrei.
"Forgive."
"Forgive what?" he asked.
"Forgive me for what I have done,"
faltered Natasha in a scarcely audible broken whisper, and began kissing his hand more rapidly, just touching it with her lips. "I love you more, better than before," said Prince Andrei, lifting her face with his hand, so as to look into her eyes. Those eyes, filled with happy tears, gazed at him timidly, compassionately, and with joyous love.
Natasha's thin, pale face, with its swollen lips, was more than plain. It was dreadful. But Prince Andrei did not see that. He saw her shining eyes, which were beautiful. They heard the sound of voices behind them. Peter, the valet, who was now wide awake, had roused the doctor. Timokhin, who had not slept at all because of the pain in his leg, had long been watching all that was going on, carefully covering his bare body with the sheet as he huddled up on his bench.
"What's this?" said the doctor, rising from his bed. "Please, go away, madam."
At that moment a maid sent by the countess, who had noticed her daughter's absence, knocked at the door. Like a somnambulist aroused from her sleep, Natasha went out of the room and, returning to her hut, fell sobbing on her bed. From that time, during all the rest of the Rostovs' journey, at every halting place and wherever they spent a night, Natasha never left the wounded Bolkonski, and the doctor had to admit that he had not expected from a young girl either such firmness or such skill in nursing a wounded man. Dreadful as the countess imagined it would be should Prince Andrei die in her daughter's arms during the journey, as, judging by what the doctor said, it seemed might easily happen, she could not oppose Natasha. Though with the intimacy now established between the wounded man and Natasha, the thought occurred that should he recover, their former engagement would be renewed. No one, least of all Natasha and Prince Andrei, spoke of this. The unsettled question of life and death, which hung not only over Bolkonski, but over all Russia, shut out all other considerations.
Chapter 33. Pierre sets out to meet Napoleon. On the 3rd of September, Pierre awoke late. His head was aching, the clothes in which he had slept without undressing felt uncomfortable on his body, and his mind had a dim consciousness of something shameful he had done the day before. That something shameful was his yesterday's conversation with Captain Rombal. It was 11 by the clock, but it seemed peculiarly dark out of doors. Pierre rose, rubbed his eyes, and seeing the pistol with an engraved stock, which Gerasim had replaced on the writing table, he remembered where he was and what lay before him that very day.
"Am I not too late?" he thought. "No, probably he won't make his entry into Moscow before noon."
Pierre did not allow himself to reflect on what lay before him, but hastened to act. After arranging his clothes, he took the pistol and was about to go out. But it then occurred to him for the first time that he certainly could not carry the weapon in his hand through the streets. It was difficult to hide such a big pistol even under his wide coat. He could not carry it unnoticed in his belt or under his arm. Besides, it had been discharged, and he had not had time to reload it.
"No matter. Dagger will do," he said to himself, though when planning his design he had more than once come to the conclusion that the chief mistake made by the student in 1809 had been to try to kill Napoleon with a dagger.
But as his chief aim consisted not in carrying out his design, but in proving to himself that he would not abandon his intention and was doing all he could to achieve it, Pierre hastily took the blunt, jagged dagger in a green sheath, which he had bought at the Sukharev market with the pistol, and hid it under his waistcoat. Having tied a girdle over his coat and pulled his cap low over his head, Pierre went down the corridor, trying to avoid making a noise or meeting the captain, and passed out into the street. The conflagration, at which he had looked with so much indifference the evening before, had greatly increased during the night. Moscow was on fire in several places. The buildings in Carriage Row, across the river, in the bazaar and the Povarskoy, as well as the barges on the Moskva River and the timber yards by the Dorogomilov Bridge, were all ablaze. Pierre's way led through side streets to the Povarskoy, and from there to the Church of St. Nicholas on the Arbat, where he had long before decided that the deed should be done. The gates of most of the houses were locked and the shutters up. The streets and lanes were deserted. The air was full of smoke and the smell of burning.
Now and then he met Russians with anxious and timid faces, and Frenchmen with an air not of the city but of the camp, walking in the middle of the streets. Both the Russians and the French looked at Pierre with surprise. Besides his height and stoutness, and the strange morose look of suffering in his face and whole figure, the Russians stared at Pierre because they could not make out to what class he could belong. The French followed him with astonishment in their eyes, chiefly because Pierre, unlike all the other Russians who gazed at the French with fear and curiosity, paid no attention to them. At the gate of one house, three Frenchmen, who were explaining something to some Russians who did not understand them, stopped Pierre, asking if he did not know French. Pierre shook his head and went on. In another side street, a sentinel standing beside a green caisson shouted at him, but only when the shout was threateningly repeated and he heard the click of the man's musket as he raised it, did Pierre understand that he had to pass on the other side of the street. He heard nothing and saw nothing of what went on around him. He carried his resolution within himself in terror and haste, like something dreadful and alien to him, for after the previous night's experience he was afraid of losing it. But he was not destined to bring his mood safely to his destination, and even had he not been hindered by anything on the way, his intention could not now have been carried out. For Napoleon had passed the Arbat more than 4 hours previously, on his way from the Dorogomilov suburb to the Kremlin, and was now sitting in a very gloomy frame of mind in a royal study in the Kremlin, giving detailed and exact orders as to measures to be taken immediately to extinguish the fire, to prevent looting, and to reassure the inhabitants. But Pierre did not know this. He was entirely absorbed in what lay before him, and was tortured as those are who obstinately undertake a task that is impossible for them, not because of its difficulty, but because of its incompatibility with their natures, by the fear of weakening at the decisive moment, and so losing his self-esteem. Though he heard and saw nothing around him, he found his way by instinct, and did not go wrong in the side streets that led to the Povarskoy. As Pierre approached that street, the smoke became denser and denser. He even felt the heat of the fire. Occasionally, curly tongues of flame rose from under the roofs of the houses. He met more people in the streets, and they were more excited. But Pierre, though he felt that something unusual was happening around him, did not realize that he was approaching the fire. As he was going along a footpath across a wide open space adjoining the Povarskoy on one side and the gardens of Prince Grusinski's house on the other, Pierre suddenly heard the desperate weeping of a woman close to him. He stopped, as if awakening from a dream, and lifted his head. By the side of the path, on the dusty, dry grass, all sorts of household goods lay in a heap, feather beds, a samovar, icons, and trunks. On the ground, beside the trunks, sat a thin woman, no longer young, with long, prominent upper teeth and wearing a black cloak and cap. This woman, swaying to and fro and muttering something, was choking with sobs. Two girls of about 10 and 12, dressed in dirty short frocks and cloaks, were staring at their mother with a look of stupefaction on their pale, frightened faces. The youngest child, a boy of about 7, who wore an overcoat and an immense cap evidently not his own, was crying in his old nurse's arms. A dirty, barefooted maid was sitting on a trunk, and having undone her pale-coloured plait, was pulling it straight and sniffing at her singed hair. The woman's husband, a short, round-shouldered man in the undress uniform of a civilian official, with sausage-shaped whiskers, and showing under his square-set cap the hair smoothly brushed forward over his temples, with expressionless face was moving the trunks, which were placed one on another, and was dragging some garments from under them. As soon as she saw Pierre, the woman almost threw herself at his feet.
"Dear people, good Christians, save me! Help me, dear friends! Help us, somebody!" she muttered between her sobs. "My girl, my daughter, my youngest daughter is left behind. She's burnt. Oh, was it for this I nursed you?
"Don't, Maria Nikolaevna," said her husband to her in a low voice, evidently only to justify himself before the stranger. Sister must have taken her, or else where can she be? He added.
Monster! Villain! Shouted the woman angrily, suddenly ceasing to weep. You have no heart. You don't feel for your own child. Another man would have rescued her from the fire, but this is a monster, and neither a man nor a father. You, honoured sir, are a noble man, she went on, addressing Pierre rapidly between her sobs. The fire broke out alongside and blew our way. The maid called out fire, and we rushed to collect our things. We ran out just as we were. This is what we've brought away, the icons and my dowry bed. All the rest is lost. We seized the children, but not Katie. Oh, Lord!
And again she began to sob.
My child, my dear one, burned, burned.
But where was she left? Asked Pierre. From the expression of his animated face, the woman saw that this man might help her.
Oh, dear sir, she cried, seizing him by the legs. My benefactor, set my heart at ease. Aniska, go, you horrid girl, show him the way,
she cried to the maid, angrily opening her mouth and still farther exposing her long teeth.
"Show me the way. Show me. I'll do it," gasped Pierre rapidly.
The dirty maidservant stepped from behind the trunk, put up her plait, sighed, and went on her short, bare feet along the path. Pierre felt as if he had come back to life after a heavy swoon. He held his head higher, his eyes shone with the light of life, and with swift steps he followed the maid, overtook her, and came out on the Povarskoy. The whole street was full of clouds of black smoke. Tongues of flame here and there broke through that cloud. A great number of people crowded in front of the conflagration. In the middle of the street stood a French general saying something to those around him. Pierre, accompanied by the maid, was advancing to the spot where the general stood, but the French soldiers stopped him.
"On ne passe pas!" cried a voice.
"This way, uncle," cried the girl. "We'll pass through the side street by the Nicolins."
Pierre turned back, giving a spring now and then to keep up with her. She ran across the street, turned down a side street to the left, and passing three houses turned into a yard on the right.
"It's here, close by," said she,
and running across the yard, opened a gate in a wooden fence, and stopping, pointed out to him a small wooden wing of the house which was burning brightly and fiercely. One of its sides had fallen in, another was on fire, and bright flames issued from the openings of the windows and from under the roof. As Pierre passed through the fence gate, he was enveloped by hot air and involuntarily stopped.
"Which is it? Which is your house?" he asked.
"Oh!" wailed the girl, pointing to the wing. "That's it. That was our lodging. You've burnt to death our treasure, Katie, my precious little missy. Oh!"
lamented Aniska, who at the sight of the fire felt that she too must give expression to her feelings. Pierre rushed to the wing, but the heat was so great that he involuntarily passed round in a curve and came upon the large house that was as yet burning only at one end, just below the roof, and around which swarmed a crowd of Frenchmen. At first Pierre did not realise what these men, who were dragging something out, were about, but seeing before him a Frenchman hitting a peasant with a blunt sabre and trying to take from him a fox fur coat, he vaguely understood that looting was going on there. But he had no time to dwell on that idea. The sound of crackling and the din of falling walls and ceilings, the whistle and hiss of the flames, the excited shouts of the people, and the sight of the swaying smoke, now gathering into thick black clouds and now soaring up with glittering sparks, with here and there dense sheaves of flame, now red and now like golden fish scales creeping along the walls, and the heat and smoke and rapidity of motion, produced on Pierre the usual animating effects of a conflagration. It had a peculiarly strong effect on him, because at the sight of the fire he felt himself suddenly freed from the ideas that had weighed him down. He felt young, bright, adroit and resolute. He ran round to the other side of the lodge, and was about to dash into that part of it which was still standing, when just above his head he heard several voices shouting, and then a cracking sound and the ring of something heavy falling close beside him. Pierre looked up, and saw at a window of the large house some Frenchmen who had just thrown out the drawer of a chest, filled with metal articles.
Other French soldiers standing below went up to the drawer.
"What does this fellow want?"
shouted one of them, referring to Pierre.
"There's a child in that house. Haven't you seen a child?" cried Pierre.
"What's he talking about? Get along!"
said several voices, and one of the soldiers, evidently afraid that Pierre might want to take from them some of the plate and bronzes that were in the drawer, moved threateningly toward him.
"A child?"
shouted a Frenchman from above.
"I did hear some squealing in the garden. Perhaps it's his brat that the fellow is looking for. After all, one must be human, you know."
"Where is it? Where?" said Pierre.
"There! There!"
shouted the Frenchman at the window, pointing to the garden at the back of the house.
"Wait a bit! I'm coming down!"
And a minute or two later, the Frenchman, a black-eyed fellow with a spot on his cheek in shirt sleeves, really did jump out of a window on the ground floor, and clapping Pierre on the shoulder, ran with him into the garden.
"Hurry up, you others!" he called out to his comrades. "It's getting hot!"
When they reached a gravel path behind the house, the Frenchman pulled Pierre by the arm and pointed to a round, graveled space where a 3-year-old girl in a pink dress was lying under a seat.
"There is your child. Oh, a girl, so much the better," said the Frenchman. "Goodbye, Fatty. We must be human. We are all mortal, you know."
And the Frenchman with the spot on his cheek ran back to his comrades. Breathless with joy, Pierre ran to the little girl and was going to take her in his arms. But seeing a stranger, the sickly, scrofulous-looking child, unattractively like her mother, began to yell and run away. Pierre, however, seized her and lifted her in his arms. She screamed desperately and angrily and tried with her little hands to pull Pierre's hands away and to bite them with her slobbering mouth. Pierre was seized by a sense of horror and repulsion, such as he had experienced when touching some nasty little animal. But he made an effort not to throw the child down, and ran with her to the large house. It was now, however, impossible to get back the way he had come. The maid, Aniska, was no longer there, and Pierre, with a feeling of pity and disgust, pressed the wet, painfully sobbing child to himself as tenderly as he could, and ran with her through the garden, seeking another way out.
Chapter 34. Having run through different yards and side streets, Pierre got back with his little burden to the Gruzinski garden at the corner of the Povarskoy. He did not at first recognize the place from which he had set out to look for the child, so crowded was it now with people and goods that had been dragged out of the houses. Besides Russian families who had taken refuge here from the fire with their belongings, there were several French soldiers in a variety of clothing. Pierre took no notice of them. He hurried to find the family of that civil servant in order to restore the daughter to her mother and go to save someone else. Pierre felt that he had still much to do, and to do quickly. Glowing with the heat and from running, he felt at that moment more strongly than ever the sense of youth, animation, and determination that had come on him when he ran to save the child. She had now become quiet, and clinging with her little hands to Pierre's coat, sat on his arm, gazing about her like some little wild animal. He glanced at her occasionally with a slight smile. He fancied he saw something pathetically innocent in that frightened, sickly little face. He did not find the civil servant or his wife where he had left them. He walked among the crowd with rapid steps, scanning the various faces he met. Involuntarily, he noticed a Georgian or Armenian family, consisting of a very handsome old man of Oriental type, wearing a new cloth-covered sheepskin coat and new boots, an old woman of similar type, and a young woman. That very young woman seemed to Pierre the perfection of Oriental beauty, with her sharply outlined, arched black eyebrows and the extraordinarily soft, bright colour of her long, beautiful, expressionless face. Amid the scattered property and the crowd on the open space, she, in her rich satin cloak with a bright lilac shawl on her head, suggested a delicate exotic plant thrown out onto the snow. She was sitting on some bundles a little behind the old woman, and looked from under her long lashes with motionless, large, almond-shaped eyes at the ground before her. Evidently she was aware of her beauty, and fearful because of it.
Her face struck Pierre, and hurrying along by the fence, he turned several times to look at her. When he had reached the fence, still without finding those he sought, he stopped and looked about him. With the child in his arms, his figure